Hello and welcome to I'll Look Into It. I'm your host, Tony Yang. Today we'll be looking into wasps and all different kinds of wasps that there are out there. We'll also be talking about phylogenetics, the reconstruction of evolutionary history, specifically about wasps. Our guest today is my good friend, Dr. Elizabeth Murray. She is currently a postdoc at Cornell in the Department of Entomology. She received her PhD in entomology from UC Riverside in 2014. She has developed and taught a course in phylogenetics. Her research centers on the evolutionary relationship of wasps. They are one of the most specioids orders of insects, and researchers are continually describing new species, finding new fossils, and uncovering new biological life histories. You can see more of her work at www.elizabethmurray.us. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Tony. Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
So this is a question I always ask the scientists in particular, but how did you get into wasp research and entomology in general? There's always a cool backstory.
Yeah, so I guess starting with entomology in general, I would have to say it's kind of always been a part of my life, I suppose, like going out, you know, maybe how kids go out collecting with nets and you're keeping bugs in your garage all summer. I did go as an entomologist for my second grade career day. So I had pretty much decided by then, I guess it was pretty close between astronaut and entomologist, but I had pretty much decided that I wanted to be working in entomology, just kind of like liking to be outdoors, loving insects.
Mm-hmm. Not everyone I know loves insects.
Well, I'd have to say there's definitely a lot of beneficial insects. Yes, we have pests too that we're dealing with, but the beauty and the benefits that we get from insects are pretty big.
So one of the interesting things is, you know, how did you get into, you know, and what, I suppose this is a better question, but what does your average day-to-day look like as a researcher and as a person with a PhD doing, you know, entomology research and then, you know, how about phylogenetic research?
So right now I'm a postdoctoral researcher, and that means that 100% of my time is devoted to research. So day-to-day basis, it really depends kind of what part of the project you're on. So say for phylogenetics, we're reconstructing evolutionary history. And for one thing, you're going to need some sort of individual organisms in order to do that with. So say I work on wasps, and right now I'm actually working on the type of wasp that you'd be really familiar seeing out around, like say paper wasps or yellow jackets. So I'm doing some evolutionary work on this family, Vespidae. And so there are two ways that we might acquire these specimens. So day to day, we might be, say, working with some museum collections and actually like just the historical collections in research museums and larger institutions. Like those collections are becoming incredibly important. And what's actually interesting is we can extract DNA from museum collections, even specimens that are quite old, maybe 100 years old, especially with some newer techniques that we're using now. And also, a lot of phylogeneticists, systematists will go out and do field collections. So this won't be something like potentially that we're going out and we have a field season, we're working out in the field all summer. This might be more targeted collection trips, and you get to go someplace kind of cool, maybe down to the tropics. Or you go and you might target a specific group, and you're going to go maybe for a few weeks, travel someplace, and do some kind of intense targeted collecting there. So that might not necessarily be then day to day, but it's definitely a part of the research life, and it's a really nice aspect of it. And besides that, I do spend a lot of time in front of the computer, especially now. It's important to get your own funding a lot of times. So you're doing grant writing. You're also one of the most important aspects, obviously, of all this research you're doing, and some of it's publicly funded through institutes such as like National Science Foundation. you're going to try to disseminate that information out, hopefully to the public, and scientists are trying to work on that and get better at that, but also just for some like scientific literature and kind of more publications in your field. So yes, a lot of computer work in that respect, but also analytical work. So there are a lot of pretty much advanced computing technologies that we use, like you're running a lot of different analytical programs when you're trying to reconstruct evolutionary history. So you'll be spending some time maybe doing some coding, some scripting, using pre-made programs and things like that.
So the question particularly about phylogenetic research is, why are we interested in reconstructing the evolutionary history, particularly of wasps in your case? Why are we interested in that? You know, what's the sort of research goal? What do we gain from it? I mean, I think a certain aspect of it is the one applicability that I could always see is, you know, how do these bugs adapt to climate change? But that's with any sort of thing. But what specifically are you interested in when you're looking at the phylogenetic research, you know, the evolutionary history of wasps?
Okay, so I have worked on two really different groups of wasps, and I can maybe kind of illustrate that point using both of these groups. So they're within this order Hymenoptera, which are like sawflies, the ants, the wasps, bees. Well, we have different parasitoid wasps, and we have wasps that are more predators. So a parasitoid is basically an insect that will kind of use a host and eat the host and kill it in the process. And a lot of these parasitoid wasps like are really, really small. And so they're pretty minute. They might be like a millimeter long in some cases. And it's actually can be hard to distinguish them by eye. So some phylogenetics and like earlier work in systematics did use a lot of morphology. So that's basically what does the organism look like? What sort of physical characters does it have? And this is important, especially for really small parasitoids. We're using them in ways that can benefit us. So like biological control. And kind of, this is an interesting aspect, biological control. Riverside, and UC Riverside is really the center of biological control. In fact, the coin, supposedly the term was coined like and used the first time at the Mission Inn, like nearly 100 years ago. You know, so biological control is like using some sort of organism in order to have some sort of effect on another organism, like a pest. So say these parasitoid wasps, we really want to know what we're dealing with if we're going to be potentially taking this biological control agent from a different country, say importing something from Asia and bringing it over here. It's really quite crucial that you know exactly what species that is and what it's going to attack, do some risk assessment in that way. So that might be, for instance, one part where we use like taxonomy, classifications, but also like what are evolutionary relatedness? What do we know about this? And now I had mentioned that I'm working on a group like paper wasps, for instance. And in this case, we're using DNA specifically, and we're using a lot of it. So some newer techniques where we are using as many different pieces of DNA really like that we can handle right now. So technology is always developing, but a lot of these analyses take a really long time. They're very complicated. So we're slowly able to incorporate more and more information. And as we do that, we can kind of get better answers to whatever questions we're asking, like the evolutionary relatedness. We might wonder like, how old is this group? Or like specific pieces, like where is the geographic origin? It's actually kind of cool that within this family of vespids, there are some species that are solitary and that some that are social, like the paper wasps you see, they're social. And it's like, well, when did that evolve? What time in geologic history did that evolve? And you can ask questions like that.
So I think that's one of the more that's one of the more interesting aspects. But maybe this is more of a general question. But why are wasps so different? I mean, I know they probably adapt to their environment, But how, I mean, you're always, I think you have mentioned earlier when we were talking about this, there are so many different types of species of wasps alone. What defines a wasp? And then secondly, you know, how many different species of wasps are there?
Yeah, as for the number of species, I guess off the top of my head, I don't know. I can tell you that there are probably well over 500,000 and potentially many more than that. So we're right now, there's been maybe 1 million insect species described, but we're constantly describing new species and kind of investigating that sort of biodiversity. And the other, wait, so the other part of your question.
The other question was what defines a wasp, given this like variation, right? You talked about something that's less than a millimeter long, that's a parasitoid, versus what we normally see, which are these yellow jackets, like we run from going, oh my God, right?
Yeah. So I guess kind of quite simply, wasps like do have a narrower waist. In a way, if you could say that, you know, you see an insect in the head, thorax, abdomen, the thorax and abdomen have this narrow waist there. but the two different types of wasps, so the larger paper wasps that we see, they can actually sting. So in the group they're in, like ants can sting, bees can sting, these wasps sting. And that's kind of a modification of the egg-laying apparatus. The ovipositor can be used as a stinger by the females. Now, with the parasitoid wasp, they don't sting, but they use their ovipositor to deposit an egg potentially right into some host organism.
So it's the use of that about that deposit. Okay,
that kind of makes the difference between the two wasps.
I never knew that. It's all educational. At least that's how we're trying to figure it out. You know, this is another question, and this may be, this will probably involve some technical, question, but you know, when you're doing phylogenetics, you're really studying like the wasp genome. Is there anything cool or interesting about the wasp's genome that, you know, maybe people should know about, you think?
Well, I think right now it's kind of still at the early stages. Yeah. So there are a couple different types of methods that people are using. Yes, we have some whole genome sequenced, and a lot of times then you can use like comparisons. So it's kind of like a comparative analysis. You'll study one wasp and what's the genome, and then another wasp, say one that's social and then one that's solitary. And it's like, where are the genes different? Potentially, what sort of changes in the genome have led to this different sort of life history? And usually for phylogenetics, we actually do not use the whole genome. We pick out pieces. So traditionally, you might hear of people using a few genes, several genes, and you can actually kind of, in a way, take these pieces from your insect genome. You take certain pieces, certain genes that you want to each compare to each other. So species A, you're going to take the same gene as species B. You take that same gene and you look at the exact same piece of the genome across all these species in order to kind of get, see their differences in a way.
Well, you want to see certain characteristics that they've developed in their genome or in their behavior, right? I mean, that's what I think a lot of this research is going towards, you know, and it's actually very intriguing. But I'd like to remind you that you're listening to Outlook Into It. Our guest today is Dr. Elizabeth Murray. She is currently a postdoc at Cornell in the Department of Entomology. Her research centers on the evolutionary relationships of wasps. So maybe to kind of just take it away from your research a little bit, but, you know, what are some interesting research that goes on in biology in general, and natural and agricultural sciences with phylogenetics? I mean, I think this is a very interesting field because we all like to study, you know, how things have kind of evolved or been bred. I mean, one of the other things I saw the other day was how everything comes from like a unique cabbage, for example. Right. Yeah, there's this original cabbage and like a lot of these legumes that we have. have like evolved from this like original cabbage. It was kind of interesting because they've done all the genotyping and everything. It's like, oh, this has been selectively bred. But you know, what are some areas that there are some very applicable areas, you know, with what can people do essentially with phylogenetics?
Right. Well, there is a quote that nothing in evolution makes sense except in the light of phylogeny. So really, people are realizing more and more that in order to interpret evolution, we actually have to know how are these organisms related to each other. You have a group of organisms that's really related, you might expect them to share a lot of the same characteristics, exhibit a lot of the same traits, potentially, than organisms that are really distantly related to each other. And then if that's the case, you have to actually interpret the traits that they're showing in the light of how distantly related they are or how old their groups are. And a lot of research, I guess, if you're talking about applying it to agricultural sciences, I had mentioned before, like biological control agents. There is a lot of ongoing research about finding what sort of maybe parasitoids, it could be different predators, like what sort of ladybug can we bring in to to eat some sort of organism? But like say the emerald ash borer that's spreading in the U.S. It was first found in the U.S. In 2002. First, you have to say, well, where did this pest come from? And probably, you know, use some sort of DNA markers and try to figure out the country of origin. But then also you can go back to the country and say, well, what sort of natural enemies are there in this case, like China or Asia? And what sort of natural enemies are there? Which ones can we bring over? How related are they to other things that we know about? And really try to solve problems of things that are like attacking or pestiferous.
Yeah. You know, you mentioned the point of, you know, relating it to other things. You know, this is always a question. I kind of know the answer, but I don't think our listeners do. But how related are native bees and bees to wasps in general?
Yeah, actually, it's pretty interesting because bees actually share a common ancestor with wasps. Not specifically the group of vespids that I work on, but some other wasps that are all generally kind of sharing the same ancestor. So bees actually evolve from wasps. So you can almost say like these wasps are like meat eating, or they're predators, and now the bees are vegetarians. So bees are utilizing pollen and nectar, but they're doing it very successfully. So bees probably originated around the time of flowering plants, you know, maybe 125 million years ago. And then they were able to really utilize that new resource. And there's about 20,000 species of bees now.
And so the interesting thing is I've also read somewhere that some wasps, like native bees, are some of the, they have some pollinator effects as well. If there are some species of it, if I recall correctly.
Right. There are other things besides bees that can pollinate flowers. Flies are often can be pollinators. Yes, wasps. But generally, bees are some of the best pollinators and have evolved different mechanisms even to get a lot of pollen from the flowers and transfer it from flower to flower. So
the interesting thing is, I know most people want to touch on this, but, you know, and you do a little bit of work on this, but, you know, what are native bees like compared to wasps and their domesticated honeybee sort of counterparts? Are they something in the middle? What are they like?
Yeah, there are so many native bees, as I've mentioned, let's say in the state of New York, there's over 400 bee species that have been identified. And a lot of times native bees they're not social typically. Well, we have bumblebees, which are also native and social. So the honeybee is not native, and I guess you've discussed that in a previous episode. But a lot of the native bees then are very important for pollination. Like, it's been shown that they can actually do a really good job pollinating different types of plants, and say apples in New York. Some of them are really teeny. Some of them are larger than honeybees. They might like look a little different and sometimes be iridescent, but a lot of them, I mean, they still have hair. So I guess the other thing is they nest in different ways. They might, some of them nest underground, or they nest in different cavities. So they have a lot of different life histories and are pretty diverse also.
So, you know, back to these wasps, what's their general role, I think, in terms of biodiversity and in the ecology of a particular region? I know that they serve as a food source for certain things, and that they serve as a predator of certain other things. Maybe you can describe that a little bit.
Right. So I guess when we're talking about predators, and so wasps are so diverse, it's very hard to generalize. But so something that you might see around Riverside, then you have your tarantula hawks, or the tarantula hawk wasps. So they're pretty large. They can be about 2 inches long. They're kind of bluish, blackish, iridescent with the orange wings. And they actually do use tarantulas. So the female will paralyze a tarantula and have to drag it away to a nest that she's made. And then in that nest, like in a little burrow or something protected underground, she'll lay an egg there and then cover up the nest, leave the egg to develop. So these, when we talk about wasp larvae, they are just little grub things. I guess they're kind of related to flies. So if you think of a little maggot, wasp larvae are kind of like the same. That might just be one instance. Maybe that doesn't affect us a lot in our day-to-day life, but actually paper wasps, they're going and they're collecting caterpillars, and they're taking caterpillars back and they're provisioning their young with those. And sometimes these caterpillars are pests of plants, you know, for our agriculture.
So I think that's always kind of interesting. But let's talk about your current research a little bit. You know, where are you going with the phylogenetics? You know, what's the purpose of it? Other than this is very intriguing. It's very obviously very interesting. But what are some of the benefits of doing the phylogenetic research, and particularly looking at these paper wasps in general? What are we trying to learn from it? What are you trying to learn from it?
Right. Well, what I'm trying to learn, for one, I'm kind of using a newer technique. So it's actually called, in a broad umbrella, phylogenomics, not just phylogenetics, but phylogenomics. So we're reconstructing evolutionary relationships, supposedly with the whole genome, but really it's just many, 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 many pieces of the genome to compare to each other. So really that's an important part of my postdoc, is just to develop or help to learn this technique, kind of develop it within this wasp group also. And we want to look at the relationships of these paper wasps, because actually it's been kind of a source of contention. Every discipline maybe has those little places where things aren't quite clear. There might be people having different opinions or coming up with different conclusions from the research. But we are trying to look at, like, how many times did this sociality evolve in wasps? Like, at what point? There are some of these in this one family of, including the paper wasp, some of these wasps actually have switched over to using pollen. So they've also become vegetarians, which has happened very rarely in Hymenoptera. So we're going to try to take a look at that group. How old is it? And then with different sorts of, like, techniques and some different types of analyses, you can also try to look at, like, what is maybe net diversification? Like, how fast was speciation? Like, is there some time point? Can we match it up to some sort of life history trait that all of a sudden allowed this group to speciate quickly and maybe kind of explode, and there are a bunch of different species? So in one aspect, the most basic part is we have to find the pattern. We have to uncover these evolutionary relationships. We basically have to put an age on things. But then you start to try to infer the process behind what you're seeing.
And I know, I actually, when I ever talk to sort of evolutionary biologists, they're just always like, it's weird. We don't know why it happens. And when it happens, it just happens. And as much like I think in certain fields in geology, people thought things happen slowly and gradually over time, as opposed to these sort of massive eruptive events. And I think that's some of where the debate probably is in your field about it, is like, well, did it happen quickly? Did it happen here? Or, you know, where did it come along? And I think that's kind of a lot where the confusion can be.
Yeah, that's insightful, though. Like, we are trying to figure out what's the tempo of diversification. You know, is there some burst at some point? Or does it happen at a pretty static rate?
Yeah. And I think that has implications far beyond just the immediate research. You know, how would you, and this is a good last question, you know, how would you advise someone who's kind of just going into the field now, or maybe a young aspiring undergraduate student that wants to go into entomology and become an entomologist like yourself? What do you think they need to be doing?
Yeah, so I know there's opportunities, say at UCR, any graduate institution or some institution that has some research aspect, that you can find someone, a faculty member, and actually start to do some sort of work with them. Maybe get paid, maybe not, you know. But it's really great if you can start to get some experience in the field. And if not, that might be okay too. I mean, you probably will have to go on to graduate school. You can decide master's or PhD, but definitely if you can somehow get a little bit of lab experience. Then.
I think that's really critical. I think that's a very sort of interesting sort of aspect with it. So are you going to continue to do this type of research, you think? Yeah, or maybe there's another sort of path that's going to happen?
No, at this point, my plan, definitely I love phylogenetics, and I kind of love the work of, you know, what species are out there, what's the biodiversity, and what can we learn? And I am pretty tied to also Hymenoptera. Mm-hmm. I enjoy working on the wasp. So I do foresee that I will be continuing this.
It's a lifetime of work. But sadly, we're all out of time. Today, our guest has been Dr. Elizabeth Murray. She is currently a postdoc at Cornell University in the Department of Entomology. Her research centers on the evolutionary relationships of wasps. Our producer is Clark Price. Our engineer has been Elliot Fong. I'm your host, Tony Yang. Tune in next time for more I'll Look Into It. Thank you for listening.